Welcome to Getting Legal With It, a podcast by Colorado Young Lawyers for Colorado Young Lawyers. I'm your host, Kevin Chaney. For those who are listening to us for the first time, I'm a personal injury and criminal defense lawyer here in Denver, Colorado. I graduated from the University of Colorado Law School in 2014 and founded my practice, Chaney, Galuzzi & Howard, LLC, a short time later. I'm a member of the Colorado Trial Lawyers Association, where I serve as the co-chair of its new lawyers division, and I also serve on CTLA's executive and legislative committees. I'm also a member of the Colorado Criminal Defense Bar Association, and finally, I serve on the executive council for the Colorado Bar Association's Young Lawyers Division. If you're interested in learning more about any of these wonderful organizations, please feel free to shoot me an email at kevin@cghlawfirm.com. Today is our third episode of Getting Legal With It. This podcast is created and sponsored by the Colorado Bar Association's Young Lawyer Division. Our goal with this podcast is to bring you monthly episodes with information that will be both fun and informative for young lawyers. We have some awesome guests lined up, and we are just getting started. If you like our podcast, please, please, please leave us a review and tell your colleagues. With that, let's jump right in. Today, we have a very special guest that I am excited about, Ms. Christina Brown. Christina, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I am doing all right. Welcome to the show. Why don't we just kind of jump right in with a little bit of information about who you are and kind of what you do. Why don't you introduce yourself to the listeners and kind of tell them where you're from?
Great. My name is Christina Brown. I'm a private attorney here in Denver, Colorado. I practice immigration law, predominantly removal defense. So I help people who are in immigration court who are fighting to stay in the United States. I graduated from the University of Denver Sturm College of Law in 2013, and I went out into solo practice shortly thereafter. I am the executive director and founder of the Colorado Asylum Center, as well a 501c3 nonprofit registered here in Colorado.
Awesome. I guess this may be a question that you've got before, but what made you want to become a lawyer? Was there a book or a movie or an event that kind of drew you to the law?
I remember that when I was five, I told my mom I wanted to be a lawyer. And then she was very supportive. So I decided I'm never doing that.
Right.
Never going to law school.
Never going to law school. Thanks, Mom.
That was my rebellion. So I started to work for a congressman here in Colorado, actually, and I was doing education and immigration work, constituent advocacy, and I realized that it was so impossible to help people from within the federal government on immigration issues, and it was very frustrating, and that I wanted to try it from the legal side, the other side, and so I actually decided to go to law school when I was working in politics, specifically to practice immigration law.
Interesting. And what kind of drew you to immigration issues in the first place? Were you kind of generally interested in politics and then kind of got into immigration, or is immigration kind of what got you interested in politics?
I was working in politics before I really knew a lot about immigration work. It was actually just working with immigrant families through the constituent advocate position with this congressperson that made me really interested in the legal side. The law seemed so complex and impossible to navigate on one's own, and it seemed like interesting to me. So I decided I would go to law school and practice immigration law and try to help people navigate it.
Interesting. What brought you to, I guess, DU? Are you from Colorado, or did you just find our state interesting? Or I say our state. I'm not a native either, but I've been here 10 years, so I like to claim it that I am.
Yes, absolutely. I am from Maryland, so I'm an East Coast woman. I came to Colorado, actually, when I was working in campaign politics. I was driving back to Iowa in the middle of a presidential campaign, and a big thunderstorm rolled in, and a tumbleweed blew across the highway, and that sold me. I decided I was coming and living here, and so that's actually what brought me here, and then I never wanted to leave. So I applied to CU and DU and went to DU and stayed.
That is some really great imagery. You know, yes. You might want to consider being a lawyer or something. I feel like storytelling, you know, could be in your future. So let's talk a little bit more about your practice. So you are in private practice here, I think you said. Where do you practice? I mean, do you have your own firm?
Yes, I have my own firm, the Law Office of Christina Brown. I founded it in 2014, a few months after I graduated from law school. But I took a break from it to go work at a detention center in New Mexico in the middle of the desert, representing asylum seekers. And so then I came back and reopened it in 2016.
And what made you want to open up your own practice rather than, you know, joining an existing immigration practice?
I was really interested in humanitarian work within the immigration field, asylum, U visas, T visas, basically helping people who are victims of violence and persecution. And a lot of existing practices don't want to take on that work because it's difficult to get paid to do the volume of work necessary in those cases. And so I noticed working for some other people that I wasn't going to be able to do the work I loved if I stayed in someone else's firm. And then a respected immigration colleague who was at that time my supervisor told me I'd never be able to run a practice doing the work that I wanted to do. And so then I'm very stubborn.
So then
I was like, I'm definitely going to do this and I'm going to be successful. And I think about him often as I run my successful practice, actually.
Yeah. You send him an email every now and then on your letterhead. That's great. There was actually some mention of some things that I don't necessarily know what they are. So I'm assuming that maybe some of our listeners don't. What is a U visa and a T visa?
Sure. So a T visa is a visa for victims of trafficking, sex trafficking, labor trafficking. And a U visa is a visa for victims of certain qualifying crimes. So basically, when someone in the immigrant community is a victim of a crime that's listed in the statute and qualifies, they can sometimes apply for a visa to remain here and help law enforcement investigate that crime. Mm-hmm. And then that can turn into residency for them down the road.
And do you do other things kind of associated with immigration law, or are you pretty much exclusively focused on asylum and kind of U visa, T visa type claims?
I do all kinds of immigration work except employment immigration. So I don't help people get like H-1Bs for doing work in the United States, but every other type of immigration law I do handle. So family-based petitions, basically anything you would need in immigration court, including the humanitarian pieces like asylum.
Sure. I'd like to talk a little bit more about kind of what it is you do kind of day to day in your practice. So we know that you're helping asylum seekers, you're helping people that have been victims of trafficking and violence, try to be allowed to stay or enter the United States. But what is the day to day practice of that? Is it a lot of writing? Is it a lot of appearing in court? For someone who has never done an immigration case, what is it that you do kind of all day?
So I have a very large volume of cases in immigration court. Most of my practice is removal defense. So I do spend a lot of time in court and preparing for asylum trials. So much of my day is spent building a country conditions index, for example, for Honduras. Someone was targeted by their government for their political opinion, and I have to prove with conditions in that country that that is something that happens and that the government is unable or unwilling to protect that person from the fear that they have. So I spend a lot of time building these voluminous records of like 2,000, 3,000 pages of country conditions, and then working with my clients to prepare declarations about the harm that they suffered and what they fear in the future in their home countries, and then preparing them to testify about that information.
How do you go about kind of building these country reports? I mean, are you sending investigators down there, or is it, you know, pulling info from Wikipedia? Is it from government documents? I mean, how do you go about proving what's happening in a foreign country where, you know, maybe you haven't been or maybe the judge hasn't been?
We do a lot of work on the internet. It's a combination of government reports and press materials. So Central America is most of my clients are from Central America, and it's very popular news item these days, Central American asylum. And so there's actually a lot of country conditions available just online. If we're dealing with something that is a little more novel, something that we don't see all the time as far as who is the person harming my client or who they're afraid of, you can hire experts who are people who have spent time in the Central American countries researching and meeting with government officials and meeting with nonprofit organizations there. And they can testify on behalf of the client if we need something we can't find online.
Sure. So you kind of talked about some of the different things. You do a lot of research, then writing these kind of country conditions, working with your clients to prep them to testify, and then actually, you know, being in court and having these type of hearings. What would you say is your favorite part about being an immigration lawyer that kind of focuses on asylum and removal defense?
Can be very rewarding, especially when we win asylum for our clients. It's really rewarding to know that you've made such a direct impact in someone's life. This is a life or death issue. It is really rewarding also that people trust you with the worst things that they've ever experienced. I am always very cognizant of that people meet me maybe a few times and then they have to spill out the deepest, darkest secrets in their soul, things that they have maybe never told anyone else, not even their family. And it's rewarding to know that you can have that type of human connection with someone.
Wow, I guess I never really thought about that a big part of asylum defense is going to be talking about the sometimes horrific things that have happened to you. You know, in a criminal defense practice, we sometimes experience some of it, especially if, you know, someone's been convicted and we're trying to explain to the court, you know, about the bad things that have happened to them, which may help explain why they in turn did bad things or when they grew up. But that's kind of fascinating to think that, you know, you're really dealing with that. I'm sure that can be very emotional and kind of stressful sometimes.
It is very emotional and it's very stressful. But honestly, one of the most stressful things is having to deal with explaining why it's difficult for people to talk about these terrible things that have happened to them in open court. Right. So
right.
I'm prepping someone and they just told me for the first time something terrible that happened to them as a child. And then you get to court and the judge is like, well, why didn't you tell us about this before? Why didn't you mention it in your first interview? Why didn't you mention it in your asylum application? You're asking people to dredge up literally their worst memories, things that they've tried to bury for most of their lives. And so it becomes more difficult when the system is so inflexible that it can't understand the human aspect of this.
And I guess that maybe that kind of hits on the flip side of that question is, what is your least favorite part about being an immigration attorney? And I guess that could be you know, something more about, you know, the outcomes or whatever, or is there something specific that, like, I don't like, you know, writing the country thing. I don't like doing this one little part of it.
There are a few things that come to mind that are difficult. One is looking at evidence in some of these cases. So we've had a lot of cases where we've had clients submit photos of their tortured spouses, the bodies of people that they love. And having to look at those and submit them to the court and talk to the client about what it is that I'm looking at, that is very difficult and emotionally charged. But the thing that is most difficult right now is that even in the best of times, being an immigration lawyer was hard, and this is not the best of times for immigrant communities. There is just a flagrant violation of law that so regularly happens in the immigration world, both in immigration court and in immigration agencies, that it's difficult to be a lawyer and to practice within the law when the government actors are practicing outside of the law.
And, you know, we sometimes, I think, see similar things happen with public defenders, and I'm sure that maybe even immigration is on a whole different level. What advice would you give to a young lawyer who might be interested in this area of law about how to deal with the kind of stress and the emotion that kind of comes from, you know, working in an area of law, like you said, that really is life or death, and where you might feel that the deck is pretty much always stacked against you?
I think you need to have a very good support network, first of all, and you have to be very good at drawing boundaries in your work and home life. It's easier said than done. I think we all talk about self-care a lot, but it's very extremely easy to burn out, especially in doing asylum work, if you don't draw those boundaries and have a good home network. I would also suggest talking to mentors. There are things that happen so regularly outside of the law in this area of law that if you were just looking at the statute and looking at the rules in court, you would miss a billion things that you needed to know to effectively represent your client. So I think making connections within the community, the legal community, for people who already do this work is really important.
Would you say that having a mentor that's kind of been doing this for a while is really kind of a vital, is vitally important when doing, you know, kind of immigration and asylum work?
Absolutely.
So I'd like to talk a little bit about the border. You and I actually office in the same building, and so I have had the opportunity to kind of learn a little bit about this. But you've actually been to... Well, let me just ask you this. How many times have you been to the border down there to do immigration work?
Oh, dear. I don't know if I have a number.
I won't put you on the spot. You can give us a rough estimate.
Well, I started my career as a lawyer, not directly on the border, but in the desert in New Mexico, representing asylum seekers who are being detained under the Obama administration. And then I've been down at least four times, if not more, under the Trump administration for representation and assisting asylum seekers who are stuck in Mexico under the Remain in Mexico policy.
And obviously, this has been in the media, and many of our listeners, you know, may have read about it. But from somebody who has been down there, what is it like? How would you describe it to, you know, our Americans and our listeners that, you know, may have never experienced anything like it?
It's not very uplifting in Mexico. The people that we were able to meet with are people, the lucky people who got to find shelter in Mexico, which is a very small percentage of people. So I went to both Tijuana and Juarez a couple of times. And in Juarez, we went to a shelter that was able to house about 100 people. Mm-hmm. We met with men, women, and children, a lot of families who were just in really desperate situations there. They had all been fleeing violence in Central America, mm-hmm. Murders of their family members, sexual violence against the women. And then they were in Mexico in this very dangerous neighborhood in this shelter where they had to buy their own food and they had to find ways to work. But they also were very unsafe when they left the shelter because they were being identified as Central American asylum seekers in the Mexican communities. And actually, the vast majority of the people I spoke with had been kidnapped both by cartels, but also by members of the Mexican federal police. And lots of people had photos and proof of ransom that they paid to be released from custody. And it was so disturbing to think about how far they had come, fleeing violence in their home countries to seek safety, only to be turned over to a government that is incapable of providing them safety.
Wow, that is very horrific, I guess, for lack of a better term. What about you personally? Did you feel unsafe when you were down in Mexico, or do they generally, you know, I guess, not target Americans, or did you think about that kind of when you were down there?
I did feel very unsafe in the shelter that we visited on a number of occasions. The people who stayed there would tell us that, you know, 2 days before you got here, a truckload of men drove through the grounds of the shelter with AK-47s, just like picking people out, right? It's really stressful, and it's really stressful to think that your presence also puts people at additional risk, even though they really need access to attorneys. Less than 2% of the people stuck in Mexico have access to counsel, and so an attorney showing up at one of these shelters is a huge deal for the people who need legal advice and representation. But also, you know, I am a white woman from Colorado, and when I show up in the most dangerous neighborhood in Juarez, that attracts attention from people around in the neighborhood, and it attracts negative attention to the people who are at that shelter. And so it's this constant, very fragile balance that we're trying to strike.
And I guess that actually leads me to another question. Is there, you know, I practice in criminal defense where there's a constitutional right to an attorney. Is there a constitutional right to an attorney in immigration proceedings? Will one be appointed to you if you cannot afford one? And kind of the things that we see with Miranda rights and on TV.
So people have a right to representation in immigration proceedings at no government expense, which means you have no court-appointed attorneys for immigration. And it doesn't even matter if you're a child. We have 2- and 3-year-olds in immigration proceedings. There was a lawsuit on this 2 years ago. And it was found that there's no right to government-appointed counsel in federal court, even for children.
Wow.
So you have to pay for your own attorney or find an organization or an attorney who can represent you for free. Unfortunately, you know, there are more than 50,000 people stuck in Mexico right now waiting to seek asylum in the United States. And there are not that many immigration attorneys in the United States who practice asylum law or removal defense. And so there's no way for people to find pro bono counsel for every single one of these families.
And that actually kind of brings me to another topic area that I really wanted to discuss. It's what organizations are you a part of? I know in your introduction, you mentioned that you had founded a nonprofit called the Colorado Asylum Center. Are there other bar associations or other groups that you're kind of involved in?
Sure. I'm a member of the American Immigration Lawyers Association and a member of their Colorado chapter as well. I serve as the co-president of the Colorado AILA Asylum Committee, and mm-hmm. I have for the past 3 years. I also serve on the AILA National Asylum Committee, where we deal with more national asylum-related mm-hmm. issues and refugee-related issues. I'm a past member of the Colorado Trial Lawyers Association, not right now. I did get a very nice award from them, the Access to Justice Award in 2015.
Wow.
Which was a great honor for me. I'm a member of the Colorado Bar Association, the National Lawyers Guild, and the National Immigration Project of the National Lawyers Guild. And I do a lot of work with local organizations. I'm a member of the Colorado LGBT Bar Association. And through my nonprofit, we have helped place volunteer cases in New Mexico with volunteers from the Colorado LGBT Bar Association
wow.
to represent trans asylum seekers who are being detained by the U.S. government.
Wow. Wow. Well, let's talk about those kind of separate them for a second. So let's start with the American Immigration Lawyers Association, which AILA, I think, is what
yes.
it is. What is it, and is that a good place for young lawyers who are necessarily maybe might be interested in immigration work or already starting a little bit with immigration work? Is that an association you would recommend they join? Are there good, I guess, CLEs or listservs or mentors that they can find through that organization?
Yes, absolutely. I would encourage anyone who practices immigration law to become a member of AILA. They do have lower rates for newer attorneys and law students. So even if you're not a young lawyer yet, you can join and start getting the information gathered that they have. They're a really good resource in terms of written documents, practice pointers, practice alerts when new information comes out in the immigration field, which is basically second by second these days.
Wow.
And they have a lot of CLEs and national conferences, webcasts, recordings that are very helpful to new attorneys. But also they're a community. So we have local chapters, and the Colorado chapter is our local chapter. And those are the people you will find to be your mentors to help you through what actually happens in the Denver immigration court and what you need to know to effectively represent your clients.
And within that community, can that also be part of the support system, I think, that you were talking about earlier, when you're kind of dealing with the stress and the emotion of this, having someone to talk to who might be going through the same thing or who have experienced the same difficulties or the same stress that you have? Is that something that you can sometimes find in AILA?
Yes, absolutely. I think it's really hard to try to commiserate with like a spouse or a friend who doesn't practice immigration law, who may not know of like your daily fight with government agencies or your daily fight trying to get your client pulled off a plane from being deported. We, a few of us in AILA, Colorado, have a happy hour in quotes because we just go to commiserate
right.
and complain to each other and get the support we need from people who truly understand what doing this job is like.
Yeah. And sometimes, again, I mean, just dealing with criminal defense, which it really sounds like some of the stuff that you're dealing with is on a different level. It can be nice just to sit there and complain just for a second and have people just listen to you and be like, yep, I understand that, you know, you seem like the deck is stacked against you, that that justice isn't always easy to find in the justice system.
Yes, absolutely.
Let's talk a little bit about your nonprofit. So that's the Colorado Asylum Center.
Yes.
And you founded that?
Yes, it was founded in the end of 2018.
The end of 2018. Awesome. And what is the Colorado Asylum Center and what is it doing?
Okay, so we are a nonprofit, 501c3. We are present to help asylum seekers, both in Colorado, but also within the United States. Our efforts right now are focused on the expedited family unit docket in the Denver Immigration Court. So the Denver Immigration Court and immigration courts throughout the United States created a faster process for families seeking asylum. And it's almost all Central American families mm-hmm. on this docket. And the point for them is to push people through the asylum process within 365 days. But many of the families seeking asylum don't have access to counsel. They're not given enough time to find counsel. They're being denied work authorization. And so they need a lot of help. Mm-hmm. So the way we're responding to that is we have an asylum application clinic that we hold monthly for families who are on that docket. If they don't turn in their asylum application by their third preliminary hearing, they're ordered removed without the chance to apply for asylum.
Wow.
And so we provide volunteer attorneys who help them fill out their application so that they can stay in the process and get a hearing on their asylum case. We also have a court watch program where we're organizing students and community volunteers to go watch what's happening in immigration court in the preliminary hearings so that we can document constitutional violations that are happening in the immigration process in court. And additionally, we're offering to people who attend our clinics the opportunity for volunteer attorneys to watch their final hearing if they're not able to contract with counsel. And so that way there's someone in the room who is legally trained to see if they're actually being given a fair hearing or not. So those are some of the activities we're doing in Colorado. We are appellate focused as far as direct representation. So our goal is to help people with appeals, to take them up through federal court and push asylum law within the 10th Circuit and in other circuit courts around the country so that we have better precedent cases in asylum.
Wow, that's really interesting. I heard you mention volunteers. So, I'm assuming that the vast majority of our listeners do not practice in immigration law, but they may, having listened today, or they may have already had some interest in trying to help this situation. Can non-immigration lawyers assist in any capacity and how?
Yes. So as far as locally through the Colorado Asylum Center, we take any Spanish-speaking volunteers or people who are non-Spanish-speaking who have a Spanish-speaking interpreter in both the asylum application clinics and the court watch programs. We provide all the training they need to help with those things. So even if you've never filled out an asylum application before, you will be trained by us so that you can help people apply for asylum.
And so just to clarify on that, so the lawyer either needs to be Spanish-speaking or be able to bring someone who is Spanish speaking with them to the trainings or the event?
Yes. Right. As of right now, hopefully we'll have a volunteer interpreter base in the future, but since it's so new, we don't have one yet. If someone's interested in volunteering, they're welcome to go to coloradoasylum.org, coasylum.org, and fill out a volunteer interest form and just note that they don't speak Spanish. And then once we have that volunteer interpretation pool in place, we can reach out to them.
For those who may not have the time or be able to commit to helping via volunteering, is there a place where they could possibly make a financial donation or support in some other way?
There are a lot of great organizations doing work on the voluminous issues in asylum law right now. I'm going to plug my own, coasylum.org. We need funding so that we can hire staff to help with more direct representation of families seeking asylum. There's also another local organization called REMAIN, the Rocky Mountain Immigrant Advocacy Network. They work out of Westminster, and they do a lot of work with children and detained immigrants who are going through the immigration court process. And then on the border, there are a number of organizations as well. I volunteer with Al Otro Lado in Tijuana. They're doing a lot of direct representation of asylum seekers who are stuck in Mexico. Las Americas out of El Paso is doing a lot of direct representation. And so all of those groups could use financial donations. And as far as new attorneys, take a case, right? You can get placed with a pro bono asylum case and get a mentor locally for someone who's either detained locally or someone who's on the in the non-detained court. And someone will hold your hand through the whole process. And then you can see what these cases are like and if you enjoy immigration work.
And I guess I had a couple questions about that. Do you, knowing that most of the people that are needing this representation are from Central America and probably speak either Spanish or some type of indigenous language to the region, is, I guess, Spanish fluency pretty much a prerequisite to be an immigration lawyer? Are there immigration lawyers that don't speak Spanish? Just something I was always kind of curious about.
There are a lot of immigration lawyers that don't speak Spanish. There are also a lot of immigration lawyers who don't do any asylum work, right? So there's all different kinds of immigration work that you could do. But there are also a lot of asylum seekers from different parts of the world. So some immigration lawyers speak Punjabi, or some speak Russian, or, you know, some speak Farsi or whatever it is. And then usually they have a client base in the language sure. that they speak, right? So my practice happens to be Central American focused because of the work I've done throughout my entire career. But there are lots of other languages that are useful in this field.
And my last question on this topic, what about, so we probably have a fair amount of law students that may be listening. Is there a way for a law student to basically get involved? Obviously, they couldn't represent a client, but can they assist at these clinics? Is there any role for law students that either may know they want to do immigration work, or they may just be interested in it, or they may just want to help? Is there a way for them to get involved even though they're not barred yet?
Yes, we need law students. I actually use a lot of law students in the asylum application clinics. We give them training and have them help us prepare asylum applications. And then I really like having law students for the Court Watch program because they know enough about what looks to be a violation of someone's rights that they take much better notes and take more useful information down for us in that setting.
And again, if a law student was interested in getting involved, they could go to, is it coasylum.org?
Yes.
Okay. I'd like to kind of shift gears here as we approach the end of our podcast and talk a little bit about just kind of being a young lawyer and kind of what that's like. So I guess to just start off is what has it been like being a young lawyer in the profession? Have you felt like your age has been a disadvantage at all? And just kind of tell us about that experience.
No, that hasn't been my experience. I think that being a young lawyer has actually really helped me build the career I wanted. Right? I mean, everyone that I worked for as a law clerk had all sorts of preconceived notions about what I would be able to do with my career and if I would be able to work in the area that I loved and still make a living. And I think being young and being flexible and being optimistic gave me an edge to build a place for myself, a little niche in this area of law that has allowed me to do what I love and be very successful at it. There are not many people who have a predominantly asylum-based practice because a lot of people haven't figured out how to make that work. And I have been able to figure out how to make that work partly because I didn't come in with all these preconceived notions that I think a lot of older lawyers are sometimes bogged down in.
What about, and this was a topic that I was discussing with a woman by the name of Jennifer Chamberlain. She was our first guest on our first episode. What about being a young female lawyer? Is that, have you seen that kind of play a role in your interactions with clients or judges or opposing counsel? Or has that not really been your experience?
It hasn't been my experience with clients because a lot of my clients are women with their kids. So I haven't had that issue with my client base, but I have experienced issues in court. I think a lot of people underestimate young female attorneys in the courtroom, both the judges and opposing counsel. So they've been very surprised at my responses to that, I think, so far. I have certainly been able to show in my short career so far that I am not incompetent, either due to my gender or my age, and that I'm very capable of aggressively and zealously representing my clients in court. But it is sometimes challenging. I notice that as a new member of some of the bar organizations I'm involved in that a lot of the male attorneys didn't want to provide mentorship or answer questions or provide any resources. It was mostly the other females in the profession that were willing to reach out and provide the mentorship and help that I needed as a young lawyer. I think that that was something that was very troubling to me because we're all in this together.
Right.
And I've seen a lot of sexism in the workplace in courtrooms. My supervisor when I was in law school was told by a judge that she had to wear a skirt or not to bother coming back to his courtroom. And those types of things, when you're a young person and you're like thinking about going into the law, can be very intimidating. But you just got to fight back, right? I mean.
Yeah. What advice, so you've been in practice 6, 7 years now?
Six years. Yes.
What advice, if you could go back in time and speak to, you know, Christina, who's just graduating law school, what advice would you give them? And what do you know now that you wish you could kind of impart on her then?
Build a good support network outside of work and find things that you love. It's not just your job.
Right.
And do those things in your spare time and build that safe time for yourself so that you can continue doing the work that you want to do. I have a very personal experience with burnout because I almost had to quit being a lawyer after my first year because I became so burned out and emotional that I wasn't capable of representing clients for a time. And I thought I was going to lose my whole career in the first 365 days. And so I really want to encourage people to keep their personal life and to create boundaries and to make some space for like living in addition to doing this work.
You know, and I'll say that, you know, I find my work to be stressful, not nearly, I think, to the same level. And that's even important for people in my practice area is to be able to have some type of outlet to do something that you can even just stop thinking about the cases, even just for a few hours. And
yes,
to remember that, you know, there is life outside of the law and every case seems so important and every client needs so much help, but you're not going to be able to help anyone if you don't help yourself.
Absolutely.
And I think that's something that it can be difficult for young lawyers to understand.
I think especially when they're coming into an occupation where people are always talking to them about how time intensive it is and how much work you have to put in order to succeed, right? Especially if you're going into a firm environment, you know, you're going to be expected to work 80 to 100 hour weeks. And there's just all of this professional pressure to do more and show that you're the best and that you're the one willing to put in the most time and the most effort. And a lot of people just let go of their personal side so that they can achieve what they want professionally. But I think that's just a recipe for very fast burnout in this field, at least.
Well, thank you so much, Christina, for being on the podcast with us today. And, you know, I'm really happy that you were here. I think that you're really doing a lot of really important work. I did not know that you had won the Access to Justice Award from CTLA. That's a very prestigious award. And just to plug Christina here for a second, she also won the Colorado Bar Association Young Lawyers Division Gary McPherson Award this year, which is arguably the most, or one of, if not the most prestigious award a young lawyer can win in Colorado for all of the work that she's doing. And I know it's very difficult, but you're fighting the good fight and doing a lot of work that a lot of people aren't. So thank you so much for being on the podcast today. If people are listening and wanted to get in contact with you to, you know, either, you know, just ask about how what you're doing in your practice or to get involved, how would they contact you?
My email address is Christina with a C-H, C-H-R-I-S-T-I-N-A at cbrownlawoffice.com. That's the easiest way to contact me. And thank you so much for having me.
No problem. As I said earlier in the show, if anyone would like to reach out to me, talk personal injury, criminal defense, getting active in your local bar association, or just to talk about being a young lawyer, feel free to reach out to me at any time at kevin@cghlawfirm.com. Thank you so much for listening to Getting Legal With It. We've got some exciting guests lined up for our next episodes, and we hope you'll tune in. And as always, leave us a review or share this podcast with your friends. Thanks. Getting Legal.